Well, I'd like to welcome everyone. This is great. Thanks for coming out tonight. And we're excited to kick off the Porch Project, the much anticipated Porch Project we're holding this summer. This has been long, years in the making, really. I found, as I was kind of getting acquainted with the project, you know, correspondence and stuff, you know, field measurements and a variety of people over the years have been involved in visioning what this could be, and we were really waiting, I think, for all the parts to come together and in terms of the people, the knowledge, the budget support resources from that standpoint, the volunteers, and it's exciting because it looks like this will be the summer that will happen, and we're really excited. So, yes. The Porch Project is something that we have to do, though we operate, you know, through our various agencies that have oversight of Holden. Holden is a historic district, and maybe John will explain a little bit more about what that means in his portion of the talk tonight. But it means that we can't just sort of make it up as we go. I think there were a number of years where we did. I will say I was guilty of being part of that. My fingerprints on a few things around here that these guys probably rolled their eyes at because we just didn't know any better what we were doing. And so, but thankfully since then, we've had some terrific kind of oversight of our preservation process here at Holden. And Forest Service is very interested in that. The State Historic Preservation Office is very interested in that. And we're really thankful to have Holden Angels who have supported it and who come, are able to meet with these folks and speak their language and really vouch for what we're, our goals are and setting their minds at ease that we're really being good stewards of the village, this historic village that we've been gifted. So with that introduction, I thought it'd be kind of fun that, as I mentioned tonight at the announcement, today we talked, you know, we got into some of the details about the project itself, and we'll get to that. But we sort of stepped back from it, and I just started asking around the table, you know, what's your story about how you got into historic preservation? It's a rather specialized field, I think, has a lot of connections between history and design and materials and building methods and all of this. And each, Harrison and John and Chris, it's kind of fun to hear each of their brief background on that and how they, because none of them sort of said, when I grew up I wanted to do this for a living. And I'm a big fan. I'll put a plug in for a book called Designing Your Life, and Glenn has loaned me his copy of it because I told him about this, but this is his copy. But this is by a couple Stanford University professors who are professors of design, and they started teaching a course. They decided, what if we could use the principles of design that we use for designing, you know, everything from, you know, architectural design, engineering design, industrial design, etc. What if you use those same principles around creating models and iterative solutions and that kind of thing towards, finding your calling in life? And the result of that was the single most popular course at Stanford University's campus is the course these guys teach, and they subsequently published a book about that methodology. And so as an engineer and sort of from my technical background, I kind of was interested in that. And then, I've found that there's a lot of principles here that I heard echoed kind of in their stories without, you know, necessarily having to follow a book to do that. But definitely suggest recommended reading here. It has nothing to do with historic preservation, but maybe a good something I thought someday we need to do a book study holding maybe on. So with that, I'm going to start with having each of our presenters give just a brief telling of what you were telling each other this morning about how you got into this, and maybe I'll start with John and then Harrison and then we'll end with Chris.
I'll come around. Well, thank you for all being so kind as to not start heckling or laughing yet. We appreciate that. I was fortunate as a kid. We had a family that had 3 weeks of vacation every summer. And we didn't have a lot of money, but we'd load up the station wagon and strap stuff all over it. So we looked like the Jode family on the road. And we went to state parks all throughout the Midwest and the West, and a lot of historic sites in those places. And I was a kid who would get to one of these spots and just imagine what happened here. And it just really stuck in my head. So that was an early influence on me. And when I was in high school, I worked in a hardware store. And it was a terrific old-fashioned hardware store where you actually had to know how to sharpen scissors and fix lawnmowers and all kinds of stuff. And I loved that job. And I would say that historic preservation as a field, for me, was a combination. It's like doing history in a hardware store. It's a great combination of those two interests of mine. Academically, I didn't start out in this direction at all. I came from a family that assumed if you went to college, you went to college as an art major. There was no other path to follow, so I did that. My academic career has been a ceaseless endeavor to earn as much money as I possibly could. So I started out as an art major, specifically in industrial design, which crosses paths into how you make things and architecture. But I ended up with a degree in religion, so that's part of that trajectory towards cash. And then I went to work in marketing communications for about 15 years, 10 of which was with the Minnesota Public Radio Network. And after 10 years of writing an annual report that basically repeated the same things, give us money, give us money, give us money, I decided I was tired of that. I started to look around and I discovered that there was a field that combined hardware store and history, and it's historic preservation. And I started talking to people who did this kind of work. And eventually I quit my job and I went to graduate school with a three-week-old baby. And I got a degree in historic preservation. So I finally got to the apex of that cash-earning quest. And I've been doing this now for a little over 30 years. And I guess a couple things I would say about the field. One is, I have very little tolerance for fancy buildings. What I focus most on are buildings that work hard in some way. So a mining town fits into that category, you know, that there was a function here that this supported. I worked on a bunch of state institutions and mental hospitals that had a job to do. A couple of ballistic missile sites, a meat packing plant. And in the last 8 years, I've been working on maritime properties in the Midwest. A guy from Iowa working on lighthouses, imagine that. But I've been in some really interesting places, and that's, I think, what keeps me doing this. So that's my story.
Harrison, you're up.
I'm up. Well, for 20 years or so, I professed to be a teacher at a state college in New Jersey. And I say professed, and some of you that have gone on and done college courses, sometimes the professor just professes that he knows something. Right? And so I thought things were going really comfortably until a branch of the college, actually it's a university now, came to me as the professor of the technology area. Would you help us move a carriage house and figure out how to move a carriage house? And it would be in about 20 miles or so, and then restore it. I said, no, I don't know how to do that. I've never done that. I don't understand that. And anyway, the story went on for a little bit more, and essentially at that stage, I didn't know how to spell preservation. Because I hadn't had any training, I hadn't had any interest, I hadn't been involved at all. I was involved in building a skill level in another direction, but why not? And so the short story of this, which isn't short anymore, is so I created a class because professors that profess can do almost anything. And maybe you've had some of those professors. And so I invented a course called Historic Preservation and put a call out for students to do a summer course in this area, and it was in another little part of New Jersey. So it all happened. We got a lot of students that were interested in something different, and it really meant being out in the field and moving a building for 30 days or whatever it was, 4 weeks or so, and move it and put it back together again.
Dang.
For a guy that didn't know much, it worked. And it worked not only in terms of moving the building. It worked not only in that the building that was going to be demolished was now saved at a school of conservation where they were going to be teaching about the environment in this carriage house. And the building is still there and still using it and still in use. So, hot shot me, not knowing anything. Let's do it again next summer. And so the next summer, I had 360 students apply for the course. And that was I never thought I would get to the point where I select who I wanted to be in my class. And so that went on, and there was a log cabin after that, and then there were other buildings, and then, well, you can do it here, you can do it in Canada. And so I took a class to Canada for a month, working on a log building also. And logs sort of became an interest of mine way back when. And it just went out of control. all of a sudden, I thought, well, I can spell preservation. So I thought I was a hot shot, and so and I wanted to do a lot more. So I picked up the phone and called the chief historical architect of the National Park Service and talked. He said, come on down, let's talk. And that led itself to a whole career. A whole new avenue, a whole new thing that I never even thought about that this could grow like this. And so the National Park Service, the chief historical architect, said, well, we have a project here, we have a project there, we have a project over here. Well, one was in Rocky Mountain National Park, and one was in Glacier National Park, and all we have a couple of them in Yellowstone. How about Grand Teton? And from there it grew and grew until I had been into 55 national parks and 59 national forests. So it's something that just grew. And for much of it, I really got back to my original skills, which was teaching. And so that then provided an opportunity to teach people in the field of preservation in many of the agencies around. So it's been an adventure that I could never believe, and an exciting one. And one that I have a great deal of pride in looking back and thinking at the multitude of buildings that I had my hand in on and made a difference.
You guys are impressive. I gotta make up something now. I'm just getting started. For me, what got me into historic preservation, I think, goes back to my early, much younger years when I was homeschooled by my mother on a hobby farm. And we did a lot of crafts and a lot of hands-on things and a lot of tinkering and tearing apart and developing those puzzle skills and those creativity skills and those dexterity skills and those practicality skills. And through my little renaissance years of my teenage times and fixing surfboards and making skateboards and being addicted to middle school and high school wood shop and made up my own wood shop during college because I wasn't really enjoying what I was doing. 2008 happened, and I was laboring in construction, building a new house. And we just had a little Donovan. And at the time, the economy tanked, and I was out of work. And a program just opened up in our local community college. This is in Astoria, Oregon, by the way, which is the oldest of white settlement west of the Rockies. So I grew up in a place surrounded with historic architecture, dating from, you know, the later 1800s up to the craftsmen of all the commercial structures of the 1930s. And there I spent my 2 years in that community college working towards my Associate of Applied Science. And that was probably the first time in my life where I was just mesmerized by what I was learning. Everything else was just a challenge and boring. And during those 2 years, I was fortunate enough to be snuck into a 5-week historic preservation field school in Port Townsend, Washington, at Fort Worden, that emphasized solely on window restoration, window manufacturing, storm sash manufacturing, and crew leadership. And through those 5 weeks of my interest and dedication, I went up the ranks of this field school to become a crew leader, where I emphasized not in the shop aspect, but in the field operations. And I think that was a great thing that I naturally was drawn towards. I owe a lot of my inspiration also to all the times I've been to Holden Village. I've always admired this architecture and the beauty of the mountains and how these passions of mine were in one place, and how, you know, I didn't know it at the time in my younger years, but it was such a mesmerizing place for me to go and explore and crawl under the porches and go to places you're not supposed to go to when you're young. And just to see and feel and experience the workmanship and the creativity. I wanted to do things that were unique, things that were kind of complicated, a lot of creativity and problem solving. And once I finished my time with the college, we moved to the Willamette Valley as a young family. You know, we had not a whole lot to lose because we were dirt poor, and I wanted to go try to get my bachelor's in recreation resource management because I wanted to restore historic parks. At the same time, I was kind of doing this preservation work as a hobby, and during my and as I was kind of introducing myself to people in my community in the Willamette Valley, when they heard that I had skills in window restoration, the next thing I knew, people were offering money to fix some of their windows. $500? Yeah, totally, I'm poor, I'll take $500 and fix this one. You know? And then this $500 led to another job that was $1,200. And then, you know, $4,600.
It's all about the money. It's all about the money.
But it was fun, you know? And these jobs kept growing and growing, and it came to the point of my love of what I was developing in this little business that I was definitely an amateur in running, was way more appealing than my misery of going through the university designing culverts and dealing with user conflicts of hunters and bird watchers. So I said, well, you know what? Someone just offered me a $20,000 job. Let's try this for the summer and just see what it does. I'm still registered for fall term. And once somebody dropped me a $52,000 job to work on a historic Coast Guard station, it came to a no-brainer. It was still hard, so hard. But after these years, 10 years in business, and my interest and love for the outdoors and what we've used for our marketing in our business model, you know, it's taken me from the idea of living in society, of restoring windows on homes and structures, which are beautiful, began to then to take me out to the wilderness to restore lookout towers and remote ranger stations. And, you know, come June, I'm working with a team that's going to pack up with mules equipment to lookout tower, dismantle, strap up, and then fly up by helicopter. Mm-hmm. You know, just the romanticism continues to grow and grow and grow. And as I feel that I've cut my teeth all these years, you know, it came to the time to feel like, you know what, I'm ready to do something different from Windows. And I'm ready to do something at a place that I love. And I want to do it in Holden Village because I feel like I'm ready. It's going to be a challenge for me, but it's a place that I love that has all the things that inspired me and is an environment and a community that loves me and appreciates me. And it takes me away from the idea of capitalism and having to be that contractor man and be a place where I can be free to be me and giggle and talk about a project. You can't do that in the real world. You have to be, or else you go under. I mean, that's what's drawing me towards this. And of course, I think mainly because I'm a geek about tools. I like to fondle these things when they're brand new. Because they're fun, because it's an extension of what I can do based on what I think and what needs to be done based on the multitude of different materials. My hobby was ceramics and glass things, and it wasn't just butchering wood, it was a diversity of mediums to create something that's crafty and beautiful and durable, and, you know, reduces the landfill and reduces my carbon footprint and energy consumption. And like you guys were saying, looking back on a project, you know, just before I came up here, 3 days before I came up here, I just finished a job that I had spent 2 years manufacturing these magnificent double-hung windows that were 5 by 9 foot tall for this old school house, and removing the 1960s aluminum windows that were no longer functional. And it's just the amount of value and pride that I felt from that makes me want to keep going and doing more. So, you know, I feel like I'm just getting started. I feel like I finally got my act together 2 years ago. And as you know, and then as time progresses, I'll feel like I got my act together up here. You know, it's always just progressively getting better, and the projects become more incredible and unique and so rewarding and self-enriching. It's addictive. It's definitely an addiction, and I love it because it keeps me out of trouble for the most part, except for when I'm gone from home for a long time. But that's changed. I'm here every morning, every afternoon, every night with my wife and children. And that is a value that I could never put money on out there in the real world because it was very hard during these times. But yeah, that's my spiel.
Great stories.
Yeah, well, let's bring it local and here to Holden. And you know, we are so blessed to have the three of you. And now we can appreciate your background and your interest in this area and the wealth of knowledge and experience that you bring, and hopefully it gives our community a sense of how fortunate, you know, we are to have you guide this and each in your own way. And so I'll just maybe 10 minutes or so each of you kind of take a little turn and talk about how you approach Holden and what your role has been in Holden's preservation efforts and maybe some unique aspects of this project in particular. The porches, we were talking today that in the 55 national parks and the 58 national forests that you've worked in, you've never seen porches like we have here. So there you have it.
They look that good. You're that cool.
So, but we'll start with John, kind of I think has had the longest period of time helping us and overseeing it.
Yeah, I've been looking at these porches since 1973, so I'm thinking it's really great that this is happening. I thought it would be, there's sort of three topics I want to briefly talk about. One has to do with, it relates to Holden's relationship with historic preservation. Why are we doing it here? One is there's a regulatory requirement, and Steve alluded to that a minute ago. There's a philosophical tie too, which I think is worth talking about, and then there's a practical part of it, and that's what these guys are really going to be focused on down the road. The regulatory part gets focused on a lot by many people, and usually with a scowl on the face accompanying the focus on regulation. But I want to talk just a little bit about what that infrastructure is and where it came from, because I think it changes people's views of what the regulatory environment is. As Steve said, we exist on a national forest. We own the buildings, the forest owns the land. The Forest Service imposes some regulations on Holden because we're on their land. But they also have responsibilities under the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966. That act was part of a flurry of environmental legislation that happened in the mid-60s. 300 and some environmental laws, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, all that stuff happened between about 1964 and 1970. The Historic Preservation Law is part of that, and it defined this stuff that we're looking at here as cultural resources, the word resource, and the built environment. So it was considered to be an environmental law. And the reason that came into being was that by 1966, a couple of federal programs had been underway for two decades that really wreaked havoc on a lot of treasured, valuable historic buildings. Those were urban renewal and the Interstate Highway Program. And at a certain point, people looked at those programs and said, a lot of stuff has been lost, a lot of stuff has been destroyed by the federal bulldozer. And so the preservation law was set up in 66, and it required federal agencies to take into account the impact of their activities on historic properties. And it was conceived as an environmental law to protect those resources. So that's where the regulations came from. We're looking at resources here. We're looking at environmental protection. Along with that, there was a set of sort of implementation standards. What do you mean when you say historic? How do you go about taking care of something that's historic? The sort of benchmark that was set up for what is historic is the National Register of Historic Places. Actually had some beginnings in the 30s. But it was that the idea was that you'd make a list, you'd identify the stuff that was important, and then you would protect it. So an orderly process. And there were criteria set up that said this is what you look at to determine if something is historic. The first one was age. Generally, something has to be 50 years old, so there's quite a few of us here. And then there are four criteria. You can have some association with important events. Well, let's look at Holden, mining. You can have association with important people, James Holden. You can have architectural or engineering value, mine and rustic architecture, or you can have the ability to yield archaeological information. So you have Winston Camp, Honeymoon Heights, archaeological sites. And all those things were looked at by the Forest Service in 1991. A determination of National Register eligibility was written, and the determination was that Holden is eligible for the National Register. It was officially deemed to be a treasure. So that's the sort of legal underpinnings of all this. And then I think it's important to think about how preservation ties into Holden's ethic. And when I think about this, this morning I walked over to the Village Center to see if one of my favorite Holden artifacts was still here. And it is. It's tucked in the corner and probably will emerge for summer. It's the lectern that Arnold Botten carved. And on the front it says, "We have this treasure." And that's part of a Bible verse from 2 Corinthians, sorry. And I think it's important at Holden to always take a Bible verse out of context and turn it to your own purposes. That's the first part of the verse. The second part is, so we have this treasure, Second part is in jars of clay. And I really like that because I think it talks about how important this place is and that it was a gift. Holden is a pure example of grace. It was, Wes Preeb did not deserve to have Holden Village given to him, despite his three letters or whatever it was. The mining company had no reason to do this, to give Wes Preeb and the Lutheran Bible Institute this place. And Holden has existed for 60 years in this place by virtue of forbearance and partnership with the U.S. Forest Service. So we exist in a straight state of grace. And I think that's an important tie to what our ethic is. And it's, if we exist in a state of grace with an undeserved gift at our disposal, I think we have a responsibility to take care of it. And part of taking care of it is to look at what makes it a treasure, some of the things that the National Register determination talked about. And then to give me a second here. We talk about this as a place apart. I talked earlier about one of the things I like about my job is that I get to go to places. And I think it's important to think of this as a place, not as a building or a bunch of buildings. It's a place, and people who come here, whether they're really aware of it or not, come to the place. There's not just the sessions, better than this one maybe, you know, not just the interesting people you meet, not just the spiritual underpinnings. It's a place, and it has physical characteristics. It's a legacy that the mining company, much against its will, built this in a rustic style to fit in with the surroundings at the behest of the Forest Service. In the 30s, they were required to make this a rustic style town site while they were allowed to rape the environment on the other side of the creek. So think of that. Even in the 30s, the district ranger would come up once a year and look at the town site, drive down to Winston Camp, and then write a report in which you'd say, that house is painted the wrong color, there are too many sheets hanging on the clothesline. So the regulatory thing has been there since day one. So we have this treasure. It's in jars of clay. That's the second part of this. And that's the nature of historic buildings is that they're old. They deteriorate, like many of us have. But there's, I think it's, from my standpoint, the best way to preserve a building is not to turn it into a museum, it's to keep it in use, to make it useful. Holden has been useful for 60 years for this enterprise. And it's also, by virtue of being used, it's been hard used, and you know, it shows some signs of hard use. So we have to take care of the place, and we have to do it in a certain way. That's another thing that the Preservation Act set up, was a list of sort of how do you go about this. And so what we're trying to do with the porch project, and in general terms, I think, is to take care of this place, to meet our stewardship responsibilities, to meet our regulatory responsibilities, but to do it carefully and to do it in a certain way, to respect the past, to respect the legacy that we were given for no particular reason whatsoever. And these guys, you know, I'm the paperwork guy, but they actually know how to do stuff. And I found today to be really exciting and encouraging. As I said, I've been looking at these porches for years, and I think it's really become evident that it's possible to do this. It's possible to fix things up. And we're in very good hands to get that process done. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think, Harrison, you have some slides to share with us?
I do. And mm-hmm. if someone has a hook, you can use it if you need to.
You're moving closer to the
audience. Let's see if I can talk to get this figured out here. Okay, sorry. I don't have it figured out yet. So, Yeah, John said a lot about, particularly some of the legal things, of why this is a historic district, and then some of the emotional things of what makes this special here. And it truly is. This is unlike many places. I happen to live on an island, and I've heard a number of times that this Holden Village being an island, and what a wonderful place to be. So, why preserve the village? Why preserve the historic buildings and the site John talked about? But for one of the things, it is truly unique in the architecture, and of course that's of my particular interest. And so the architecture really is something that goes back, maybe some of you can relate to hearing about the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, and the fact that the country was coming out of a major depression and people needed jobs, 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 and so this was created, the CCC was created to put people to work, but also to preserve the environment. And it was a period of time of learning about and feeling close to nature, sort of, or at least at a point where the automobile allowed people to get to where they could go look at nature. And there was a lot of movement about the nature at that time, and natural architecture. And that was the kind of thing that CCC management was essentially created, this artificial kind of architecture that looked like it related, it belonged in nature. And so that meant that in areas where there were forests, then we saw buildings with log elements everywhere, and elements that just didn't make any sense to have wood sticking out horizontally out of a building, because anybody just looking at it would know it's not going to last very long, designed this way. But do they have that special look and the special feel to them? When you go to the Southwest, then the buildings take on the feeling of the desert and of openness, and buildings became long and narrow and brownish in color, and had unique kind of architectural features to them along the way. So, Holden Village is really unique in all of that. It blows me away. So I have a couple of photographs, and we'll talk about that. Don't get me started on some of these topics because I go on. So, and I only Steve has a book over here. Okay. So obviously, as John was saying, we're not only just talking about the buildings, but we're talking about the site, the cluster of the buildings together, and where it is. So they really go hand in hand. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? Why are we preserving it? Huh? How are we doing this? Well, I guess you're going to leave it up to me. Well, what are we... We have this wonderful collection of these buildings together, probably the most unique that I've ever seen this way. And are we going to let them deteriorate and lose this feeling that the buildings create for us and the site creates for us, the people that do this? Or are we going to, how long do we want these buildings to last?
And,
40 years is a good number? And then they fall down? 100 years, maybe? 100 years. Well, what happens after 100 years? The word that often is said is in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. Well, I can't even figure that one out along the way, but just think back now. If we want the buildings, if we want to pass on these buildings, this heritage, this wonderful architecture onto other people, then we have to take care of it now. Mm-hmm. And we have to do it methodically. And if we deviate from that because it's expensive to do it this way, let's just chop off all of these logs out onto the end that are deteriorated, and then the problem goes away. Wait a minute now, something's wrong with this picture. You see, we need to deal with preserving the appearance and the history and the architecture and a lot of things along the way. And you know what the village is like here, and essentially it's chalets and service areas and lodges, and you know more than I do about that, and you certainly know about all the buildings here, but one of the unique, truly unique things about the village here is the log work and the enormous amount of log work that comes out of this architecture from the CCC buildings. How many of you have been to Yellowstone and Glacier and Yosemite and literally just about every state park has buildings and pavilions and picnic areas that were built during the CCC period, and indeed are that part of that rustic architecture that we know, and sadly, think about this, we'll never do it again. We don't know how to do it, we don't know how to work the tools, we don't have the money to do it that way, we don't have the will to do this kind of architecture that we have spread around through the country. And so, yeah, you may not be on mainline of a state park, but here you are, really have a gem of rustic architecture. Mm-hmm. And it's something within itself to preserve. Okay. So 3 years ago, I was asked to come here and enjoy myself. and look at all this wonder of, oh my God. Enough is enough. How many of these? Well, anyway, so I was in my glory, and it was only a few days, and so it was interesting trying to look at all of this, think about all of them, and think of the implications, and what does it all mean for preservation, for trying to preserve these buildings. And so that's what got me involved. Just a couple of things along the way. For me, and in terms of being a conservator, an architectural conservator, one of the things I'm looking at are, what are we preserving? What we call this are the character-dividing features. Think of it, when we first met, one way or another, you recognized me, or maybe you didn't, but as an individual, I'm this guy with white hair and a white beard and the other character-defining features. Okay. And that's how we tell each other from one from another. So what we see on the buildings are each building, each of us, but also each of the historic buildings, have certain features to them that are important to preserve. Mm-hmm. We can't really preserve everything necessarily. Some things are out of control. Some things just because of time is different. Sometimes because we have modern conveniences that we need to deal with. But what our mission is the character-defining features. Think of your house, for example. Wherever you are, put a building in your head somewhere along the way, and think about what a character-defining feature might be. Maybe it's the roof. Maybe it's the front door. Maybe it's the color of the paint, or the combination of colors. Maybe it's the way it's constructed. Could be even the site that's sitting on a slope somewhere, and the house is built into it, or it's sitting on top of it, or it's close to the street, or it has this great vista to it, or it goes on and on and on. So those things that define that structure and the site then are the things we want to preserve. So here we're looking at the architectural elements, and they just happen to be that rustic architecture. Stairs. The stairs just stand out. Every building here almost pops out in your image of as well as the porches and the posts and the railings. And so that's what we're really here to preserve. If we put in a metal railing in place of the log balustrades with the poles across, then we have lost the integrity of that building. And so the difficult part is figuring out how far can you go. We had an incident this afternoon when we were looking at building Chalet 6. To the point of saying, should this be knit? Should the railing be nailed together? Or should it be a screw that in the future we can take the screw out easily without damaging the wood? Or historically, it was a nail that got rust around the outside because of the nail, and nails always want to back out. So which is better? Well, that gets down into the finite kind of details. Sometimes that makes sense of how are we dealing with it today when the thing was built in 1938? Well, imagine what goes on in the year 21,002, all right, projecting it on way out onto the future, because we'll lose track of what it was originally. Okay, enough on that. So building 4, Lodge 4, has some interesting elements to it. And these are some of the things that are going to be dealt with, or must be dealt with. And you know all about that because you've been walking around here. Let me go back again because it didn't do what I wanted to do. But the extending elements that are coming out of the building. They're a mess, and we all know that they're not going to last very long, but it defines that building very clearly and this period of architecture. So this is an area that needs to be addressed, certainly for sure, and not only on the lodges but on all the buildings here, and that's what makes it really interesting and unique. Okay. The posts. I think the posts have said enough of the snow. I can't take it anymore. So these the wonderfulness of that vertical look that brings it as a part of the forest, its roots are rotting here along the way, and decay is setting in. And so then becomes the real serious question of, as those in the past have said, well, we need to do something with this, so we will cut a notch in it and stick a new piece together. And you can see clearly how some people in the past have done this treatment. There is no question in my mind that these kind of treatments were met with the best of intentions. It was the best that was known within the limit of time or limit of money, limit of skill, limit of know-how. They thought this was an appropriate way of dealing with it. But these are the areas that we're going to, sorry about that, Chris is going to be dealing with in terms of how to treat this. Boy, the railings just stand out. No matter where you are in the village here, the railings are all over the place, and you just see them in abundance. And unfortunately, just about all of them, except for two, Chile two, and maybe a few others then, but are all in a very serious state of condition and coming apart. Stairs, of course, and decks, and the likes, and here's a couple other layers of that get involved with in preservation and safety issues. And so there are a lot of layers, but stairs certainly are one that are a critical factor here in the work that's going to be done. The finish didn't work. It just needs attention, obviously. And as a result, many of the log elements are deteriorated, not just only because of finish, but it doesn't have a protective coat to it. And so that needs to be dealt with. And when I was here before, someone was actually, was at the jacuzzi, someone was using Minwax helmsman, but as I walk around, I've probably seen 20 different colors and types of finishes, and there needs to be some standardization, not only in finish, but standardization in terms of the log elements and the post of how things are done, because they were all done uniformly and at the same time originally. And so there ought to be some standard for that. The railings are obviously all a little different. Back to that with the best of intentions. But they also need a set of standards. And so standards will help along the way as management changes, as volunteers change, as a part of history. What did it look like now? We can think back, maybe some of us can, back to 1938, or we can think of what we see now. But when I start talking about numbers of 50 years from now, 100 years from now, what are we going to know that isn't as the original integrity of the buildings? And we deserve to be able to preserve that footage. And so that means some documentation for that part of it, too. Everywhere I look on a historic building, there's a drainage problem. It just is an automatic kind of thing. And issues with grade and vegetation that's growing up near the building that has some impact on it. So this is sort of something that I've been focusing on here recently, is predictive maintenance, not necessarily preservation maintenance. And think about that for a minute. Because there are a lot of these things that we're looking at, we know what's going on. We know what's going to happen along the way. So we need to look at them carefully and predict how long they're going to last and how to treat them. And that's the building, and you can see the stairs, the railings, the balustrades, the extending elements to it. And I hate to put it in these words, but this didn't work. This is sort of a hodgepodge here, but again, with the best of intentions of trying to do it with whatever means that there are. Okay, so what that meant was when I was here 3 years ago, I put together a plan of how to deal with building with Lodge 4. And this is what I'm here, and John and Chris are putting up with me of talking about how to go about doing this. Not only what should be done, but the procedures and the process of how to make it happen, and how to make it happen with volunteers. Okay. So, I deal with preservation in my mind when I'm at a building, of looking at it from a couple different ways. One of which is, did I brush my teeth? You did, okay. You brushed it, all right, good, cool. Are we keeping clean? Or preserving them that way, and that in a daily or in a periodic process of caring for what's going on. Doesn't mean that we're replacing elements and logs and repainting and doing whatever, but on a periodic basis, we understand a bit more about predictive maintenance. So why don't we stop at that point and take care of the buildings as they are now on a daily basis? It doesn't mean we have to make the repairs. I'll go back to my own teeth. So I'm going to brush my teeth, but I'm not going to put a new crown on. I'm not going to repair a cavity at all. I'm going to try to preserve as much as I can forward. And it's really a relatively simple process with a building. We know where some of the problem areas are and how to take care of them on not necessarily a daily basis, maybe it's on a monthly basis, more likely it's on a season, maybe even on a yearly basis. But if we get into a routine of caring for them, we're not likely to find the other problems down the pipe. So you've probably had a cavity, and that happens because maybe we didn't clean properly. So then there are ways in which we can make the small repairs to a log or to a lot of other elements of the building that keeps it moving on as the deterioration occurs. A crown, although this is showing as a cap or a crown top, if you will, this way. Some of the elements out there are coming out horizontally rather than vertically or whatever, is that we can make an attachment by attaching some good wood to the area that was defective or that was degraded by decay. And then the ultimate is, well, if we have to, and there's no other alternative, then we just have to replace it. So that would be, isn't that the order when you go into a dentist, that you would prefer this sequence of events on your mouth? And so what do we do with a historic treasure of a building?
Don't go there, Harrison.
Okay, so think about this as Chris will be doing of looking at this as these levels of intervention on the building. I think that's enough.
I think it's a really good segue, and I think what I'm going to, we're excited because Chris has already kind of talked about this idea that our porches could be part of our programming this summer, and that people are going to be able to watch and see how we approach these this project, and we want it to be very visible. That's why part of the reason we've chosen Lodge 4 and Chalet 6, they're fairly visible ones along the path to 10 Mile, the other right by the Arc. So Chris is very excited about, I think, using it as a demonstration opportunity. And maybe what we'll do is we'll let you, we'll be giving you opportunities in the future now to kind of share your knowledge of how you're going about these, the work, and you know, looking at maybe having some time now to, we'll kind of conclude for the evening, but I would encourage people to stay and ask questions of John and Harrison, and Chris will be here to maybe give a little tool talk here over the fire ring there about some of the interesting equipment that he'll be using, as well as the more mundane Milwaukee drills and what we were talking about earlier, and epoxy systems. And there's also some really good show and tell from Harrison. He brought some samples of different systems as well. So, thanks for coming out tonight. Hopefully this gets the ball rolling and the pump primed for this. We have slots now where we're filling up. Marta has been helping recruit for our volunteers porch team, and I think we've got maybe four the first week are coming. And
five.
Yeah.
Good. Maxed out.
So these next two weeks, you're going to see Chris crawling all over these and kind of creating that plan, and then we're going to launch it there first week of June. So stay tuned for opportunities for Chris to explain kind of how we, as we kind of unpeel the onion and decide how we're going to go about this. There's many more questions right now than there are answers, but that's sort of the process of going into this and sort of the meeting of the minds of these past couple days. Thank you for coming out tonight.
Thank you.